Good morning and welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Brian Field and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. And our speaker today is New York City performance poet Taylor Malley, a veteran of the HBO series Deaf Poetry Jam. Malley has won the National Poetry Slam Championship four times. He's published two books of poetry, several CDs of spoken word, has narrated six audio books, and for a brief time, he was the official voice of Burger King. For 9 years, he taught college, high school, and middle school, and once, in a single Scrabble game, he earned a score of 581. Please help me welcome Taylor Malley.
In 1997, I went to a New Year's Eve party where an arrogant young lawyer insulted me and the entire teaching profession. Teachers are so overworked and disrespected, he reasoned, that anyone who would willingly choose to become a teacher today must be of questionable intelligence and therefore shouldn't be allowed to teach in the first place. It was like something a mean-spirited Groucho Marx would say. Anyone dumb enough to want to be a teacher shouldn't be allowed to be one. For the lawyer, it really came down to how poorly compensated teachers are. No intelligent person would take a job that paid less than what he was making as a lawyer. At the party that night, I was so furious inside that I couldn't come up with a clever comeback, so I bit my tongue and I laughed politely. But the next day, January 1st, 1998, I wrote a poem that was the forceful response that I wish I had delivered that night, and the poem was called What Teachers Make. I didn't publish it in a book until a couple years later, but I did post it immediately on my brand new worldwide website, which, like many other websites at the time, had several pages that said either coming soon or under construction. And shortly after I posted the poem, I started to get a lot of emails about it. What Teachers Make had struck a nerve. It's about defending teachers and why we teach, and our anger at being judged at the size of our paycheck instead of by the difference that we make. The poem speaks to people, teachers and non-teachers alike. Unbeknownst to me, it was copied and pasted and emailed around the world, sometimes without my name attached to it, forwarded by friends with apologetic disclaimers about how they don't normally forward things, but you have to read this. The poem was excerpted by famous people giving speeches and delivering commencement addresses. Newspaper columnists wrote about the poem and quoted from it. Seattle Public Radio did a story about it. Other versions of the poem were written, either to clean up my language. I was angry when I wrote the poem, and that anger did affect my word choice, or else to make the poem fit other professions. Eventually, someone posted a video on YouTube of me performing the poem live, and that's when it really took off. Millions of people have now watched and listened to the poem What Teachers Make. It seems I was lucky enough to capture in words what many people have thought but never quite been able to say. In two different ways, however, the poem What Teachers Make changed my life more than it did anyone else's. First, it changed my job. When I wrote the poem, I was still teaching in a regular classroom. But 2 years after writing it, I decided to put my teaching career on hold, to quit my day job, as they say, to see if I could pay the bills as a touring poet and advocate for teachers. I now make my living traveling around the world, teaching poetry, talking to teachers about how to teach poetry, and simply reminding teachers why the path that they have chosen to walk is noble, valuable, and crucially important. I am following my dream now, and have been doing so for the last 12 years. But what teachers make changed my life in another, more appreciable way as well. People started to become teachers after reading it or hearing it. I started getting emails from college students saying that they had decided to change their major to education and that I was at least partly responsible for their decision. And that made me feel like I was making a difference in people's lives. So after a couple dozen people told me that they had decided to pursue a career in education, after reading the poem, I gave myself a goal. I would convince 1,000 people to become teachers through nothing more than the passion with which I spoke about the teaching profession. I called it my quest for 1,000 teachers. Suddenly, I had a new purpose in life. I had a vision for something larger than myself. And on a practical level, I had another reason to write every morning. And that has had a profound impact on me. I'm not just writing to delight and instruct anymore. I'm writing to try to change the world, one teacher at a time. Of course, in the grand scheme of things, even after I finally reach my goal of helping to create 1,000 teachers, which, incidentally, I did on April 7th of this year, 2012, I approved the 1,000th person to credit me, at least in part, with their decision to teach live at the Bowery Poetry Club in New York City, and marked the occasion by cutting off 12 inches of my hair and donating it to the American Cancer Society. But even then, even after having reached that goal, I know that I have done virtually nothing to help improve education in the United States. Serious inequalities remain in the way schools are funded, and teachers are under attack for being incompetent and lazy. These are problems that require more than poetry. In fact, sometimes I think I merely make the problem worse. What am I really but a propagandist who mollifies teachers into accepting the status quo? I sometimes feel this way when I am worn out from the fight. But I always come back to the fact that being a teacher is one of the greatest jobs in the world. And sometimes the people who have chosen to walk that noble path simply need to be reminded that there is a vast army of educated and grateful citizens who has their backs. Someone needs to remind teachers that they are dearly loved. And apparently, I'm that guy. Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My talk this morning is called What Teachers Make, which, as you now know, is also the title of my most well-known poem. But What Teachers Make is also the title of my new book of essays, the introduction of which I just read to you. It was published by Putnam earlier this year, and it is my love letter to teachers and anyone who has ever known a teacher that made a difference. It's also the story behind the poem, What Teachers Make, the personal philosophy that lies behind almost every line of the poem. So it seems only fitting that a talk called What Teachers Make, that starts with a reading of a chapter from a book called What Teachers Make, which is at one level about a poem called What Teachers Make, should progress with a recitation of the poem What Teachers Make, or Objection Overruled, or If things don't work out for you, you can always go to law school. He says the problem with teachers is, what's a kid going to learn from someone who decided that his best option in life was to become a teacher? He reminds the other dinner guests that it's true what they say about teachers. Those who can, do. And those who can't, teach. I decide to bite my tongue instead of his. And resist the urge to remind the other dinner guests that it's also true what they say about lawyers, because we're eating, after all, and this is supposed to be polite conversation. I mean, you're a teacher, Taylor. Come on, be honest. What do you make? And I wish he hadn't done that. Asked me to be honest. Because you see, I've got this little policy in my classroom about honesty and ass-kicking, which is, if you ask for it, then I have to let you have it. You want to know what I make? I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. I can make a C-plus feel like a Congressional Medal of Honor, and I can make an A-minus feel like a slap in the face. How dare you waste my time with anything less than your very best? I make kids sit through 40 minutes of study hall in absolute... No, you may not work in groups. No, you cannot ask me a question, so put your hand down. Why won't I let you go to the bathroom? Because you're bored, and you don't really have to go to the bathroom, do you? I make parents tremble in fear when I call home at around dinner time. Hi, this is Mr. Molly. Hope I haven't called at a bad time. I just wanted to talk to you about something that your son said today in class to the biggest bully in the grade. He said, hey, why don't you leave that kid alone? I still cry sometimes, don't you? It's no big deal. And that was the noblest act of courage that I have ever seen. I make parents see their children for who they are and who they can be. You want to know what I make? I make kids wonder. I make them question. I make them criticize. I make them apologize and mean it. I make them write, 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 and then I make them read. I make them spell. Definitely beautiful. Definitely beautiful. Define nightly. Beautiful until they will never misspell either one of those words again. I make them show all their work in math class and then hide it on their final drafts in English. I make them realize that if you've got this, then you follow this. And if somebody ever tries to judge you based on what you make, you give them this. Here, let me break it down for you so you know what I say is true. Teachers, teachers make a difference. Now, what about you? For the rest of the morning, I intend to tell stories. Some of these stories may arrive in the form of poems, and others may not. If you know the brilliant young poet Sarah Kay, who is a colleague of mine and will soon be a mentor of mine, but who used to be a protege of mine, then you may agree with her conclusion that it's hard to know when Taylor Molly is reciting a poem and when he is just talking. This, by the way, is me just talking. Some of the stories will be about teaching, which is a kind of poetry. Some of them will be about poetry, which is a kind of teaching. Others will be about the other three big topics that are up in my life right now: love, sex, and divorce. The big three, the LSD of modern poetry. But first, here is a very tightly rhymed poem dedicated to a woman who may or may not be in the audience, a woman I only know from the single letter she wrote me a few weeks ago, in which she explained that even if she does attend this morning, she will not introduce herself to me, despite having bizarrely similar life experiences. For instance, we have both survived the suicides of our first spouses. Here is The Ocean Inside, or Why One Teacup Fell But Not the Other, dedicated this morning to Nancy. The wind is strong. It's a choppy sea. Most things upright are not stable, but standing there in front of me are two teacups on the galley table. One red, one blue, standing tall on the table after breakfast in front of me, until the ship lurches and the red cup falls, a victim of the swell of the sea. Why would one fall but not the other? I ask as I reach out with one hand. Why the red sister but not the blue brother? And then grasping, I understand. The blue, still upright, standing there, has tea too hot to drink. It's full, but the red one was empty or full of air, and so did not feel the ocean's pull and sway, or rather did, but would not match that lurching with a similar motion. The tea could do what the air could not, mimic the rocking of the turbulent ocean. No metaphors here, just this understanding. Whenever you're traveling the ocean wide, be like a teacup if you want to stay standing, at least partly full of the ocean inside. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Lily Wilson at my office door. Lily Wilson, the recovering like addict, the worst I've ever seen, so like bad that the entire eighth grade started calling her like Lily, like Wilson, like, until I made my classroom a like-free zone, and she could not speak for days. But when she finally did, it was to say, "Mr. Molly, this is so hard. Now I have to think before I say anything." Well, imagine that, Lily. It's for your own good, even if you don't like it. I'm writing the poem that'll change the world, and it's Lily Wilson at my office door. Lily is writing a research paper for me about how homosexuals, like, shouldn't be allowed to adopt children. So I think I'm writing the poem that's going to change the world, and here comes like Lily, like Wilson at my office door. She's having trouble with her paper. She's having trouble finding sources for her paper, which is to say, ones that back her up. They all seem to argue in favor of what I thought I was against, and it took 4 years of college and 3 years of graduate school and every incidental teaching experience that I have ever had to let out only, "Well, that's a very interesting problem, Lily. What do you propose to do about it? That's what I want to know." And the eighth grade mind is a beautiful thing. Like a newborn baby's face, you can often see it change before your very eyes. "I can't believe I'm saying this, Mr. Molly, but I think I'd like to switch sides. And I want to tell her to do more than just believe it, but to enjoy it. That changing your mind is one of the best ways of figuring out whether or not you still have one. Or even that minds are like parachutes, that it doesn't matter so much what you pack them with, so long as they open at the right time. Oh God, Lily, I want to say, you make me feel like a teacher, and who could ask to feel more than that? I want to say all of this, but I manage only, Lily, I am like so impressed with you." So I finally taught somebody something, namely how to change her mind, and I learned in the process that if I ever change the world, it's going to be one eighth grader at a time. Thank you. It's true that I do not use the word like unless it's a verb or a preposition, never as a comma. But the greater challenge that I have given myself, and the one that makes people think that I might always be in the middle of a poem, is the fact that I have managed somehow to train myself never to say or when I speak, except as examples of the words that I do not say. Now I just pause when I'm about to say one of those words, and suddenly I sound twice as smart as I actually am. And perhaps as a result of this reputation I have for speaking clearly and exactly, many people, when they meet me for the first time, they try to rehearse in their heads what they want to say when they get to the head of the book signing line. And sometimes they put so much pressure on themselves to be articulate that they actually forget everything that they were going to say, turn red, and in the case of more than one person over the years, as charming, tongue-tied nervousness begins to turn with each awkward, silent second into epic mortification, they literally run away. And this next poem is for them. It is called Any Language, Much Less English. When I speak to people, I don't look them in the eyes. I pick one, usually the left one, and I sink into it all the way up to my ears, unblinking, and I don't look away no matter what they say. And I suppose that makes me look somewhat intimidating. And since by far the hardest part of listening is keeping your own mouth shut, I try sometimes, just for fun, to breathe deeply through my nose until my interlocutor is absolutely, entirely, completely, totally finished. And I've heard this makes me look angry. And of course, I'm a teacher, which apparently means that I might at any moment whip out a red pen and start X-ing your language in the air, circling every word you mispronunciate and correcting your stultifyingly inelegant syntax, irregardless of the context in which you are speaking in. For crying out loud, you are killing me. That could be part of the explanation as well. But that being said, standing in front of me, speaking face to face, some people seem to forget how to speak any language, much less English. So I'm here to tell you that I don't speak in poetry when I talk. I say like and whatever and you know without end. I'm such a terrible speller that I once told a girlfriend she was the passion of my lions. Having said that, I use these phrases all the time to mean I will stop talking eventually, just not at any moment in the foreseeable future. It's true, in public, you need not only a vision, but an eloquent way to convey it. But in private, I care more about what you say than the words you choose to say it. So that being said, and having said that, the message I want to impart is I don't care if your commas are in the right place, so long as I know that your heart is. The last two poems that I recited highlight my predilection for imitating people, calling them out on their sloppy habits of expression. Call it parody in the service of pedagogy. I do that a lot. But there is usually a redeeming quality to the poem that lifts it out of the realm of mere mockery. Usually. But not in the case of this next poem, which mocks overly academic poets, the kind of highbrow literary poets who might get invited to speak at respectable summer lycea. I should mention that this poem is not actually published in my book, The Last Time As We Are, although for the radio audience, I will be pretending to read it out of there. Also, for the benefit of the radio audience, I have just put on a pair of drugstore reading glasses that I do not, in fact, need. In the pantheon of Greek gods, Hephaestus was the god of fire and metalworking, smithy to the gods, if you will. He was also, who can yell out who Hephaestus was married to? Aphrodite, correct. The goddess of love, a fate, I suppose, as deserving of our pity as of our admiration. Yes, yes, you would know. But enough jokes. I didn't come here to entertain you. I came to read a poem. So without further ado, I present the Apologia of Hephaestus in four cantos. 1. Winter. Cold, hard stone. Cold, hard igneous rock formation of stone. Cold like black ice, and hard also like black ice. Though not black and obviously not even ice, a metaphor in any language. As did Christ mourn from the cross in ancient Aramaic, Eli, Eli, lama, lama, sabachthani, so I lament on the streets of the Nazareth of my mind, the deconstructed kiosk of otherness. 2. I am the academic poet's poet who stands aloof and above, not so much in love as I am in love with the love of love. Betwixt my writing and my reading, you may notice a certain disparity, but whate'er my performance may lack in brio, I make up for with a well-rehearsed clarity. 3. Out of nowhere and without warning, a barn owl swoops for a field mouse in the church of the non sequitur. IV. The way it all adds up, the way a poem is written, the way it is read, the way silent applause will not wake the dead, the way the end sneaks up on you. Is this the end of the poem? No one knows if they should clap yet. How am I doing on time? Thank you very much. You will never hear me say, "How am I doing on time?" I like to take questions in the middle of my readings instead of at the end, but before I take the first question from Brian, I should mention that I do have a real love for academic poets, particularly those who have a sense of humor about themselves, and those are the only kind that I invite to be a part of a series I run in New York City called Page Meets Stage, where I invite on the third Wednesday of every non-summer month, one academic poet, possibly a Pulitzer Prize winner. We've had 3. Possibly the current or former U.S. Poet Laureate. We've had 2. And I pair them with a stage poet, somebody more like me, maybe a Poetry Slam champion or a spoken word poet. And the two of them read back and forth, poem for poem, creating a kind of conversation. If you think you might be in New York City on Wednesday, September 19th, 2012, to hear Thomas Lux and John Sands, then pick up a flyer after this reading or visit pagemeetsstage.com. Brian, can I have the first question, please?
You certainly can. And the first question is, can you speak about a teacher or teachers that made a difference in your life?
Oh, I absolutely can, and I often do. Can I have the second question, please? No.
You certainly may. You seem to mock classical poetry. Do you really feel we have nothing to learn from it? Or is it just an easy mark for parody?
Both. It is an easy laugh to mock poetry, classic poetry, but there's a lot of wonderful classic poetry that does have a sense of humor about itself. Shakespeare knew that he was writing for 2 audiences, those in the seats, the expensive seats, and he needed to include a certain amount of bawdy material for the people who were standing in the pit. And as the ambulance drives by the church, I know that I have to have a certain amount of poetry for the ambulance driver to hear as he goes by. To go back to the first question, I've had great teachers in my life, the greatest being Dr. Joseph D'Angelo, my fifth and sixth grade English teacher, who was a PhD and a black belt in karate and an opera singer. But all of the greatest teachers that I had, the one thing they had in common is I could sense the very palpable love for me that they had, and I did not want to disappoint them. And that's what makes a difference between a teacher. You should not spend any time trying to make your students like you, because that will backfire. It's not important that they like you. What is important is that you love them, especially if you don't like them. Next question, Brian.
What about fun as an adjective? Where have all the adverbs gone?
I don't care where the adverbs have gone. They can all go and die a miserable death. The adverb is my least favorite part of speech. There is usually a verb that describes how you did something instead of choosing the weaker verb and a modifier for it. Fun as an adjective? Wow. We had a fun activity? Are there actually grammarians out there who lament the fact that fun changed from a noun to an adjective? Wow, these are my people. And here I thought I was alone in lamenting reference as a verb, or access as a verb, or agendize. Here I thought I was the only person who lamented the decline of the subjunctive. My brother wanted to create a society for the defenders of the subjunctive, which as a tense is so much more important in other language like Spanish or French, and we only use it it only affects the verb to be in English. If I were you. But my brother always wanted to set his sights on other verbs that would be affected by the subjunctive. And he set his sights on the verb to have. And he wanted to use the subjunctive in expressions of wishing or doubt. He wouldn't say, if I had $1 million. He would say, if I had $1 million. But I'm not with him on there. Brian, can I have one more question?
You can. And this is it. If you could change one thing about schools, specifically high schools, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about high schools nationally, it would be to put a national cap on class size at about 23. When I become king, I will create, federal monies will be available and will kick in as soon as a student is added and there are 24 students in the class, they will automatically, by federal law, have to be split into two sections of 12. Kurt Vonnegut said that teaching is the most wonderfully rewarding profession so long as you never have more than 17 students in a class. I last taught at a private school where we got up on our high horse and were insulted and complained to the administration if we had 16 students in our class. We had a small school, small classroom, and to be fair, 16 students was too many for those rooms. But there are public school teachers in this nation, possibly even in New Hampshire, who have approaching 40 kids in a class, possibly without even a teacher aide. If you could manage to get all 40 students to hand in the 5-paragraph essays on the day that they were due, and you did that with all 5 of your classes, you have 200 essays that you now have to grade. And you should grade them that night and get them back the next day, because that's how you improve writing. One of my teaching mentors used to have the essays were due in his office at 8 o'clock on the day that they were due. Not when you have him for class. They're due at 8. And he returned them as the students left school that day. Luckily, he had the freedom not to have all of his sections hand in papers on the same day. So he would only get a batch of 16, and he would read them. That day, he would eat lunch at his desk, and he would just grade the papers. And you picked up the rough draft. You picked up the draft on your way out of school, and the final draft was due the next day. That's the way you teach writing. But if you're a public school teacher and you have 40 kids in your class, and they all manage to hand in the papers on the same day, do you really have the energy to grade that and say, this is nice, now, tomorrow, do it again and make it better? That's what I would do, small class sizes. Read me two more questions and I'll answer one of them if I like it.
Now that you've encouraged 1,000 young people to become teachers and appreciated an endeavor, how can those new teachers find positions in school systems which continue to reduce their staff and everything else that's good?
Okay, that's one. And now the next one.
Have you had the opportunity to see the dinner guest lawyer since you wrote the poem? And if so, what happened?
The answer to the second question is no. And the answer to the first question is, I don't know. Is that not helpful? I have convinced 1,000 people to become teachers. It was a very unscientific quest. It started when somebody said, hey, you know what? I've decided to become a teacher, and it's partly due to the way you talk about the teaching profession. I said, oh, you know, that's interesting. You're probably the 9th person to tell me that. And then I said, you know what? This is a big deal. Maybe I should be a little bit more rigorous about keeping track of this. And I kept track online, and then I devoted a special blog to it. And now, if you go to my website, Taylor, which is exactly what you would think it would be, taylormolly.com, Molly spelled like the African country, which often is not helpful for people. Don't you mean Bali, which is not in Africa? Molly, which I found out listening on NPR, Molly is becoming the new haven for terrorists. Mali is where Timbuktu is, the ancient city of Timbuktu. How did I get into this? Oh, taylormolly.com has a list where you can see the names of all the 1,000 people, at least the first names of the people who did that. I didn't follow up with them and to see whether now, 12 years later, all of them are still teaching. And I also had a very loose definition of what it meant to be a teacher. If somebody said, listen, because of you, I've decided to teach jujitsu and Hebrew and mandolin at a very special school after school, do I count? I would write to them and say, God bless you. Yes, of course you count. The only people I had to turn away from my list were people who said, I saw your poem, What Teachers Make, and I've been teaching for 45 years, but can I be on your list as well? And I would have to say, no, I'm sorry. You do not count. How do I make sure that those people, those young folks who have become a teacher and I'm responsible, find jobs in schools that are actively working to diminish class size? That is the question to which I answered, I don't know. I sort of feel like that's not my department. It's hard enough simply to find the right people to enter the teaching profession, but I will work on that. The other question is, the lawyer whom I wrote the poem about probably does not even know or would recognize himself in the poem. In the poem, I make it sound like it was a dinner party with just a few of us. It was actually a New Year's Eve party, and there were hundreds of people there, and he was the host, and he is 6'5", and very good-looking, and with shoulders very broad, and very charming. And so I was very intimidated when he said that, and he had hundreds of guests he needed to attend to, so he probably moved on and doesn't even know the vitriol with which I speak of him in my work. Let's do one more, and then I may come back to you later.
Name 3 books you haven't read, yet are on your to-do before your final breath poem list ends.
Three books I have not read that I will read. I told myself I was saving War and Peace until I was 40. I'm 47. I still haven't gotten around that to it, so I've got that looking forward to me. Those who have read and swear by Anna Karenina tell me that I have that to look forward to. So let's say that. And just to give myself an air of respectability that I don't actually possess, I will say Finnegan's Wake. I always like to read a poem, a new poem, a fresh poem, a poem that is still in the process. So here is one that I finished on Friday, and it is called Finding a Railroad Spike for Rachel. Tonight, when you found on our walk along the tracks after dinner a rusty iron railroad spike behind the bar and beamed at it, bent, hard, and rusty, I told you of the abandoned line through my family's farm, how my father said they ripped up all the rails in the run up to World War II for bullets, a story which, if it is only a story, I single-handedly loved until it bloomed into historical fact. Back then, we found iron spikes just like the one you hold now in your hands, mostly after my father dragged the cinders black and smooth with a square of bolted timbers chained to the back of his Jeep like a traveling sandbox pulled through the forest, or like a giant picture frame lying flat made from the trunks of fallen trees. In its wake, the old spikes simply churned to the surface of time's black gravelly cinders. We found so many and counted ourselves so blessed and well-loved that we learned to leave them where they lay, half revealed in the black cinders, to be found by guests and brought home and loved, like you, like me. The past is rarely rustier than this, nor feels more good, grounding, and solid than when you clutch an ancient railroad spike and feel its iron ethic in your hands, its history of hard use, bent back slightly like stiff with age. Listen, here is what I know now to be true. In another life, I was a railroad spike, strong, hard, rusty, and slightly bent back, stiff sometimes, but still capable of being driven straight if pounded true. That is what I wish I'd said to you tonight, that me and my love, we are railroad spikes. Here are two poems for my soon-to-be former wife. Love poems I wrote for her the entire third section of The Last Time As We Are is things I've learned about life. I say it's divided up into three sections. It's all about learning. The first section is things I learned about life in the classroom. Second section is called Life Work, and it's things I learned about life in the living room. And the last section is called Homework, and it's things I learned about life in the bedroom. And they are all love poems, and all of the ones that I wrote for Marie Elizabeth, I now look at and say, were they trying to tell me that my marriage would not last? Or were they just celebrating that little irritating grain of sand that is necessary in oysters to make pearls and in the hearts of poets to make poems? Love, hungry for itself. I love my wife, but I have never loved her the way she deserves to be loved. nor has she loved me in the same way. Once we went to bed together, too tired to do anything but kiss, which we did with our lips drifting. But after the first dream, love hungry for itself, we found ourselves making more with great desire and the divinity of dark. So leave me this great imperfect love in which the body knows to seek what the heart does not think it needs. The space that long-term love requires. My wife and I are getting a new bed, a bigger bed, a king. And everything arrived today. The frame, the two twin extra-long box springs, everything. Everything that is except for the mattress, which comes tomorrow. So tonight, we are sleeping for the last time on our old queen mattress, which lies in the middle of the vast new king-sized bed like an island. The extra distance that we will soon have between us, visible now in the gaps that we each must cross to get to sleep. But because I come to bed after a hot bath, already sweating and flushed as though after making love, only to find love wrapped in the down comforter, freezing and not wanting me to turn on the ceiling fan because she is, as she says, friolenta, prone to coldness, I am here on the terrace off our bedroom in New York City, naked in the early March night, cooling off and staring out at the moon and the lighted clock of the MetLife Tower on 14th Street. It is probably safe to say that we will not be having sex tonight. Not with me standing naked on the terrace, standing, in fact, now up on one of the wooden patio chairs for all the midnight world to see, steam rising from my body like prayers to the night, the moon, the face of the clock, asking for more time to get this thing right, which has become my life, while my wife lies wrapped tightly in goose down, big, thick, sexy wool socks on her feet, shivering in the middle of a bed bordered on both sides by the same thing, half the distance in inches between a queen and a king. Brian, I'll take two of your favorite questions that are left. If I don't answer your question, feel free to accost me afterwards.
I shall.
Not you. Them.
I still may accost you later.
All right.
Okay, as a teacher, I find that teachers are not being heard in education. We see an increase in administrative levels, spending on scripted programs and test prep. How can we reverse the trend?
Teachers need to speak up more, and we don't often speak up because we have what we thought was real work to do. We're so busy doing what we have to do that we feel like we don't have the time to make our voices heard to the administration. So often you see a bunch of administrators getting together deciding what is best for teachers. Once Yeats said that education is not about filling a bucket, but lighting a fire. And once I went down to the mailroom at the last school where I taught, and I was in such a good mood. And there was the head of the upper school, and he said, "Mr. Molly, why are you in such a good mood today?" And I said, "I have been lighting fires all morning." And he said, as only an administrator can, "Didn't I hire you to put fires out?" And what I should have said was, "No, that's your job." And every fire that I light in the minds of one of my students is one fewer you will have to put out. Final question, please, Brian.
Are teachers' unions the enemy or friend of learning?
They're like charter schools. They're both the problem and part of the solution. That's all I'm going to say about that. I've got two more poems to do, and this first one is about Maria Elizabeth and how when I used to leave her sleeping in the morning, she would often be on her side with her hands clasped together as though in prayer, like this. And so I wrote this four-line poem. It's a quatrain. It rhymes, A, B, A, B. And the poem said to me, you need to sing me. And you need to keep singing me until the audience learns the words and starts singing along, possibly even harmonizing. So you're going to have to sing loud or else the radio audience will think it is just me. I am going to sing this through four times. With any luck, it won't just be me singing at the end. Benediction for the morning. She clasps her hands together while she sleeps to cast a spell against the dark night air, or as a way to bless the secret dreams she keeps. For what is dreaming but a kind of prayer? She clasps her hands together while she sleeps to cast a spell against the dark night air, or as a way to bless the secret dreams she keeps. For what is dreaming but a kind of prayer? She clasps her hands together while she sleeps to cast a spell against the dark night air, or as a way to bless the secret dreams she keeps. For what is dreaming but a kind of prayer? She clasps her hands together while she sleeps to cast a spell against the dark night air, or as a way to bless the secret dreams she keeps. For what is dreaming but a kind of prayer? Let's do an amen. Amen. Thank you. My final poem is dedicated to all the teachers out there. Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful series. What do I forget to say? Follow me on Twitter. And enjoy the day. Oh, and I'm part of the Word by Word Festival in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Not this coming week, but August 11th through the 17th. World-class spoken word poets coming to Berkshire County. Join me there. This last poem is dedicated to all of the teachers in the audience. It is called The Miracle Workers. Sunday nights, I lie in bed, awake, as all teachers do, and wait for sleep to come, as though sleep were the last student in my class to arrive. My grading is done, my lesson plans are in order, and still sleep wanders the hallways like lower school music. I'm a teacher, this is what I do. I'm a miracle worker. Like a builder builds, or a sculptor sculpts, a preacher preaches, and a teacher teaches. We are experts in the art of explanation. I know the difference between the questions to answer and the questions to ask. That's an excellent question. What do you think? If two boys are fighting, I break it up. But if two girls are fighting, I wait until it's over, and then I drag what's left to the nurse's office. I'm not your mother, I'm not your father, I'm not your jailer, I'm not your torturer, I'm not even your biggest fan in the whole wide world, even though sometimes I act like all of these things. I know you can do these things that I make you do, that's why I make you do them. I'm a teacher and that's what we do. We're miracle workers. once in a restaurant when the waiter said, "Can I bring you anything else?" And I said, "No, thank you. Just the check, please." And he said, "Oh, come on. How about a look at the dessert menu?" I knew I had become a teacher when I said, "What did I just say?" Please don't make me repeat myself. In the quiet hours of the dawn, I write my assignment sheets and then I print them without spell checking them. Because I'm a teacher and teachers don't make spelling mistakes, do we? So as a matter of fact, the new school dress code will affect all members of the 5th, 6th, and 78th grades. And if you need an extension on your essays examining the pubic wars from a hysterical perspective, you may have only until January 331st. I hope that's not a problem for anybody. I like to lecture on love. I like to speak on responsibility. I talk about the importance of telling the truth always. And when my students say, "Mr. Molly, is this, are we going to be responsible for this?" I say, "If not you, then who? You think my generation is going to be responsible for this? We're the ones who got you into this mess. Now you are our only hope." And when they say, "What we meant, Mr. Molly, is are we going to be tested on this?" I say, "Every single day of your lives." Once, while a student of mine was digging in her backpack for a pen, I put on the corner of her desk a pen, but she didn't see me do it. So when I crossed to the other side of the classroom and she raised her hand, still not seeing the pen that I had put on the corner of her desk, and said, "Mr. Molly, do you mind if I borrow a pen from you?" I went, She still didn't see it.
You already possess everything you require to succeed, including a pen. Whoosh.
Boing. For a second, she still did not see the pen that I had put on the corner of her desk, but said instead, "Mr. Molly, you are probably the weirdest teacher I have ever had. Could you please just loan me up?" Oh my goodness! How did you do that? You're a miracle worker. And I want to say all I did was give you what I knew you needed before you knew you needed it. So thank you for the compliment, but education is the miracle. I'm just the worker. I'm a teacher, and that's what we do. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Have a great rest of your summer. Go in poetry. Let poetry bless your lives. And those of you listening on the radio, come one Sunday morning.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program this Sunday after next, August 19th, will feature Wesley Wildman, who will be speaking about technology and the future of religious experience. Thank you.